Part 3. Even in cases in which the detention of enemy combatants is legally authorized, there remains the question of what processes constitutionally do to a citizen who disputes his enemy combatant status. Hamdi argues that he is owed a meaningful and timely hearing and that extrajudicial detention that begins and ends with the submission of an affidavit based on third-hand hearsay does not comport with the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. The government counters that any more process than was provided below would be both unworkable and constitutionally intolerable. Our resolution of this dispute requires a careful examination both of the writ of habeas corpus, which Hamdi now seeks to employ as a mechanism of judicial review, and of the due process clause, which informs the procedural contours of that mechanism in this instance. Section A. Though they reach radically different conclusions on the process that ought to attend the present proceeding, the parties begin on common ground. All agree that absent suspension, the writ of habeas corpus remains available to every individual detained within the United States. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. Only in the rarest of circumstances has Congress seen fit to suspend the writ. At all other times, it has remained a critical check on the executive, ensuring that it does not detain individuals except in accordance with law. All agree that suspension of the writ has not occurred here. Thus, it is undisputed that Hamdi was properly before an Article III court to challenge his detention under 28 U.S.C. Section 2241. Further, all agree that Section 2241 and its companion provisions provide at least a skeletal outline of the procedures to be afforded a petitioner in federal habeas review. Most notably, Section 2243 provides that the person detained may under oath deny any of the facts set forth in the return or allege any other material facts. And Section 2246 allows the taking of evidence in habeas proceedings by deposition, affidavit, or interrogatories. The simple outline of Section 2241 makes clear both that Congress envisioned that habeas petitioners would have some opportunity to present and rebut facts, and that courts in cases like this retain some ability to vary the ways in which they do so as mandated by due process. The government recognizes the basic procedural protections required by the habeas statute, but asks us to hold that, given both the flexibility of the habeas mechanisms and the circumstances presented in this case, the presentation of the mob's declaration to the habeas court completed the required factual development. It suggests two separate reasons for its position that no further process is due. Section B. First, the government urges the adoption of the Fourth Circuit's holding below, that because it is undisputed that Hamdi's seizure took place in a combat zone, the habeas determination can be made purely as a matter of law with no further hearing or fact-finding necessary. This argument is easily rejected. As the dissenters from the denial of rehearing on bank noted, the circumstances surrounding Hamdi's seizure cannot in any way be characterized as undisputed, as those circumstances are neither conceded in fact nor susceptible to concession in law, because Hamdi has not been permitted to speak for himself or even through counsel as to those circumstances. Further, the facts that constitute the alleged concession are insufficient to support Hamdi's detention. Under the definition of enemy combatant that we accept today as falling within the scope of Congress's authorization, Hamdi would need to be part of or supporting forces hostile to the United States or coalition partners and engaged in an armed conflict against the United States to justify his detention in the United States for the duration of the relevant conflict. The habeas petition states only that when seized by the United States government, Mr. Hamdi resided in Afghanistan. An assertion that one resided in a country in which combat operations are taking place is not a concession that one was captured in a zone of active combat operations in a foreign theater of war, and certainly is not a concession that one was part of or supporting forces hostile to the United States or coalition partners and engaged in an armed conflict against the United States. Accordingly, we reject any argument that Hamdi has made concessions that eliminate any right to further process. Section C. The government's second argument requires closer consideration. This is the argument that further factual exploration is unwarranted and inappropriate in light of the extraordinary constitutional interests at stake. Under the government's most extreme rendition of this argument, respect for separation of powers and the limited institutional capabilities of courts in matters of military decision-making in connection with an ongoing conflict ought to eliminate entirely any individual process restricting the courts to investigating only whether legal authorization exists for the broader detention scheme. At most, the government argues, courts should review its determination that a citizen is an enemy combatant under a very deferential some evidence standard. Under this review, a court would assume the accuracy of the government's articulated basis for Hamdi's detention as set forth in the Mobs Declaration and assess only whether that articulated basis was a legitimate one. In response, Hamdi emphasizes that this court consistently has recognized that an individual challenging his detention may not be held at the will of the executive without recourse to some proceeding before a neutral tribunal to determine whether the executive's asserted justifications for that detention have basis in fact and warrant in law. He argues that the Fourth Circuit inappropriately ceded power to the executive during wartime to define the conduct for which a citizen may be detained, judge whether that citizen has engaged in the proscribed conduct, and imprison that citizen indefinitely, and the due process demands that he receive a hearing in which he may challenge the Mobs Declaration and adduce his own counter-evidence. The district court, agreeing with Hamdi, apparently believed that the appropriate process would approach the process that accompanies a criminal trial. It therefore disapproved of the hearsay nature of the Mobs Declaration and anticipated quite extensive discovery of various military affairs. Anything less, it concluded, would not be meaningful judicial review. Both of these positions highlight legitimate concerns, and both emphasize the tension that often exists between the autonomy that the government asserts is necessary in order to pursue effectively a particular goal and the process that a citizen contends he is due before he is deprived of a constitutional right. The ordinary mechanism that we use for balancing such serious competing interests and for determining the procedures that are necessary to ensure that a citizen is not deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law is the test that we articulated in Matthews versus Eldridge. Matthews dictates that the process due in any given instance is determined by weighing the private interest that will be affected by the official action against the government's asserted interests, including the function involved, and the burdens the government would face in providing greater process. The Matthews calculus then contemplates a judicious balancing of these concerns through an analysis of the risk of an erroneous deprivation of the private interest if the process were reduced, and the probable value, if any, of additional or substitute safeguards. We take each of these steps in turn. 1. It is beyond question that substantial interests lie on both sides of the scale in this case. Hamdi's private interest affected by the official action is the most elemental of liberty interests, the interest in being free from physical detention by one's own government. Freedom from bodily restraint has always been at the core of the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause from arbitrary governmental action. In our society, liberty is the norm, and detention without trial is the carefully limited exception. We have always been careful not to minimize the importance and fundamental nature of the individual's right to liberty, and we will not do so today. Nor is the weight on this side of the Matthews scale offset by the circumstances of war or the accusation of treasonous behavior. For it is clear the commitment for any purpose constitutes a significant deprivation of liberty that requires due process protection. And at this stage in the Matthews calculus, we consider the interests of the erroneously detained individual. Procedural due process rules are meant to protect persons not from the deprivation, but from the mistaken or unjustified deprivation of life, liberty, or property. The right to procedural due process is absolute in the sense that it does not depend upon the merits of the claimant's substantive assertions. Indeed, as amicus briefs for media and relief organizations emphasize, the risk of erroneous deprivation of a citizen's liberty in the absence of sufficient process here is very real. The nature of humanitarian relief work and journalism present a significant risk of mistaken military detentions. Moreover, as critical as the government's interest may be in detaining those who actually pose an immediate threat to the national security of the United States during ongoing international conflict, history and common sense teach us that an unchecked system of detention carries the potential to become a means for oppression and abuse of others who do not present that sort of threat. The founders knew the history of the world told them the nation they were founding, be its existence short or long, would be involved in war. How often or how long continued, human foresight could not tell, and that unlimited power, whenever lodged at such a time, was especially hazardous to free men. Because we live in a society in which mere public intolerance or animosity cannot constitutionally justify the deprivation of a person's physical liberty, our starting point for the Matthews v. Eldridge analysis is unaltered by the allegations surrounding the particular detainee or the organizations with which he is alleged to have been associated. We reaffirm today the fundamental nature of a citizen's right to be free from involuntary confinement by his own government without due process of law, and we weigh the opposing governmental interests against the curtailment of liberty that such confinement entails. Two, on the other side of the scale are the weighty and sensitive governmental interests in ensuring that those who have in fact fought with the enemy during a war do not return to battle against the United States. As discussed above, the law of war and the realities of combat may render such detentions both necessary and appropriate, and our due process analysis need not blink at those realities. Without doubt, our Constitution recognizes that core strategic matters of war-making belong in the hands of those who are best positioned and most politically accountable for making them. The government argues also at some length that its interests in reducing the process available to alleged enemy combatants are heightened by the practical difficulties that would accompany a system of trial-like process. In its view, military officers who are engaged in the serious work of waging battle would be unnecessarily and dangerously distracted by litigation half a world away, and discovery into military operations would both intrude on the sensitive secrets of national defense and result in a futile search for evidence buried under the rubble of war. To the extent that these burdens are triggered by heightened procedures, they are properly taken into account in our due process analysis.